Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Nikki Carulla. We're going to jump right into this quarantine edition of Wake Up Hollywood. With us tonight, we have sitarist, musician, composer, Josh Feinberg. Say hello, Josh.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, man, you sound great already. You got a radio voice, man. And I love that you're wearing, are you wearing a juba? Is that what you're wearing?
Kurta.
Oh, a kurta. Okay, all right. It looks
Fab India, too, so fabulous.
Very nice, dude. I like it. So, you know, we're going to jump right into this. You played piano and bass at a young age, and you were, like, way into jazz, and you were studying with all these jazz greats. Tell me, like, how that came about, how you got into music. What was your moment of zen getting into music?
You know, music always had a really strong impact on me from the time that I was a kid. You know, I remember you and I think, are about the same age, like late 30s.
I'm 41, so I appreciate the compliment, though.
All right, well, ballpark.
Close enough, yes.
I'm going to call myself mid-30s, okay, just because nice. I'm going to round down.
That's perfect.
So you remember we had those little LP players, like the little kid versions?
Oh, yeah, totally.
So I had this little kid LP player, and it was plastic. It was like a Fisher-Price.
I think I had the same one. Was it red by chance? Because mine was red. I totally remember that.
And I used to play La Bamba on repeat for, like, I don't know, I must have worn that thing out. And I really have no idea what it was about that song, but I probably drove everyone in my house crazy listening
now,
to
it. Now, are you talking the Richie Valens version or the Los Lobos version?
The original.
Oh, very nice, dude. Very
and,
nice.
And so Music always really, really moved me and really touched me from the beginning. And when I started learning piano, I'm naturally kind of a bit rebellious. I don't like being told what to do.
You're like, I'm gonna just do what I want.
Yeah, and so my teachers would try to get me to read music, whatever, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I would just like compose my own little stuff. And they would teach me stuff by ear. That was the only way they can get me to, like, play these Mozart and Bach and, you know, classical pieces that I was learning. But I was always more interested in, I looking back, I loved that stuff. And I'm really glad that I studied it. And I still listen to it now. But my primary musical love was improvisation. You know, I loved just being in a moment and feeling that energy and feeling it from the crowd and feeling it from my fellow musicians and kind of riffing off of each other. That was really it. And so I got really into jazz from there. And then one of my jazz teachers, who's now when I was learning with him, his name's Dan Weiss. When I was learning with him, he was pretty fresh out of college in his early 20s.
He's a beast.
He's a beast. And now, like, everybody knows who he is. He's like this big name in the drum world. At the time, he was, you know, kind of a kid. But to me, he was like 10 years older than me. And so for those of you who don't know Dan Weiss, definitely check him out. His album Stair Baby is like unreal. It's so good.
And he's an East Coast cat too. I think he's New York, right?
So I grew up in New York City.
That's right.
And Dan was learning tabla with Pandit Samir Chatterjee, and so he introduced me to Indian music.
Oh, wow.
And
how old were you, do you think?
probably about 15.
Okay. Okay. That's definitely not the norm, man. I come from India, and I wasn't listening to Indian music at 15, you know?
I'm a weird guy. What can I say? So you're from L.A.?
I'm from L.A., man. But we're interviewing you today. Let me ask you this. So you're listening to the sitar. You're listening to these Indian ragas. Well, do you remember the first thing he played for you? Because everything about Indian music, it goes against Western music on so many levels. Sometimes it's scales.
It does and it doesn't. You know, I think on the surface, there's a lot that's different. But, you know, being someone who has learned jazz, classical, bluegrass, like basically a lot of different types of Western music, or at least music that has, I mean, with jazz and bluegrass and blues, things like that. It's Western music fused with various African traditions.
Right.
But at the, you know, at least part of it is Western music. And then coming to North Indian classical music or Hindustani music, you know, there's a lot that's different, but I also hear a lot that's similar. And I think there's almost as much that's similar as there is that's different.
Like, give me an example. What's a parallel you think that is completely, you know,
unaware? Okay, so here's a really just kind of straightforward example. Indian music is based on scales, which move certain ways. There are melodic forms. You can think of it like one-way streets sometimes, where like a note can only go in one direction.
Right.
Or like after you play this note, you have to follow it up with this phrase, things like that. But beyond that, it's also very pattern-oriented. In Western music, you would call it a sequence, or put like a diatonic sequence.
Right.
So if you listen to Baroque music, for example, a lot of the same patterns that we use in Hindustani music are also used in Baroque music.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they're run through chord progressions rather than being centered on a single tonality.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would never make that parallel, but I can see it. I can totally hear it and see it.
Yeah, there's, especially with Baroque music, there's a lot of common ground there.
And did you playing piano, did that help you when you made this transition to sitar? Like, was there kind of like a learning curve that you were probably more advanced at because you had some musical expertise in playing bass and piano?
Yeah, so I was definitely more accomplished as a bass player. I played piano until I was, I mean, I still play piano, but I studied it until I was about 11. And then from there on, I started playing bass at 8, and I switched to the bass pretty seriously around like 8, or sorry, I started at 8, and then I switched around 10, 11, 12. I got really serious about it. So it's definitely, I mean, music at its core is all melody and rhythm, and that's the same kind of skill set no matter what music you're playing. You know, like if you can do a certain rhythm on a drum set, you know, you have to learn the mechanics of playing it on the piano, but you've already learned that rhythm. You already can do that thing. You can
right.
You can conceive of it, or there's a fun word, you can audiate that rhythm. You can hear it in your
nice.
Mind.
Nice, good know? Word. So what, great, how old are you? How old were you when you started playing sitar?
So I got my first one when I was 15.
Okay.
And I got it off eBay. And I
That's
kind
crazy.
Of
crazy.
Yeah, it was not a good instrument. I will temper my language for the interview.
you can swear, man. If you want to swear, you can swear.
yeah, well, my Indian fans and friends might listen to this, and I'll just I won't go there. But anyway, it was not a good instrument, and I actually called a gentleman, an Indian gentleman in New York, to learn with him, and I was kind of overwhelmed by the instrument, and I was overwhelmed by the cultural difference, and I broke a string almost immediately, and I just kind of like threw my hands up, and I was like, I can't do it.
Well, and it's how many strings does a sitar have? I don't even know.
So there are a few different styles, but usually somewhere around 20 strings.
Wow.
So there
are, what are the gauges of the strings?
The main string, so if we use You want standard or metric?
Give me both. Just so I have an idea.
So the main string is usually 0.012, which would be three gauge in the British system. And that's steel. Most of our playing is done on that string.
Wow.
And then the second string is 0.016, which is phosphor bronze. After that, it's 0.022 and then 0.028. And the bottom three are phosphor bronze.
So it's almost like a B string, a G string, a D string on a guitar.
Well, so you asked me before if there were some like preparation that helped me. Well, the sitar is actually tuned to the same tuning as a bass in drop D tuning. So in terms of the fingering, it's like identical, really. The main difference is
tuned in fourths.
It's too well. So the first three strings are in fourths, and then so it's G, D, A, low D.
Oh, I see.
But the main difference there is that we actually pull the string. You can bend the string on the main playing string. We can pull five or sometimes six notes.
Oh wow!
And on the bass string, you can pull almost a full octave, maybe a minor seventh.
So the tension is not really tight. It's pretty loose.
It's a loose. A loose tension.
Oh, yeah. Wow, man. When I watch players play it, it doesn't seem – well, maybe it's the what I'm hearing that makes it sound like it's not loose. Because when you see them vigorously playing, but the sound of it sounds like they're playing metal, you know, like like it sounds like they're playing a rake, you know what I mean? So I always just assumed the strings were heavy gauge and something with it, you know. And also, like, the frets sometimes move. Like, I've seen I've been so curious. I saw Ravi Shankar like years ago, and I remember just watching him move the frets. And I was just like, what is he doing? Is he changing the tuning? Is he changing the gauge? Like, whatever that is, it's so fascinating. So when you're playing sitar and you're changing the fret positions, what are you doing? Are you changing the tonality?
Yeah. So there's a couple different reasons why we move the frets. First of all, like you play guitar, right?
Yep.
So
I play guitar, piano.
Before guitar had inlaid frets, they were actually tied on the same as the sitar.
Wow.
The guitar actually is in the lute family, same as the sitar. And all those instruments can trace their origins back to Persia. I mean, that's why they sound similar, guitar, sitar.
Right, right.
They're all, from the Middle East originally. And so back then, the frets were actually tied on, or sometimes like certain instruments like the rabab, for example, the fret is just a tie. It's just like a thread, basically, that's wrapped around the neck, and that's what stops the string. With the sitar, it's the instrument itself is not chromatically fretted, so it's missing some frets. So sometimes we have to move the frets to get the other note. You know, if we're tuned to like a natural second, or we would call it shudre, and we want to get the komulre, the flat second, then we have to move that fret backwards, you know, a half step.
And you would do it sometimes in the middle of a song, correct?
Not so much in the middle of a song, but before you begin.
Because I would hear it, like sometimes he would be playing with his daughter, and his daughter would be playing, and in the middle of the song, he would move the fret.
Yeah, so that can happen. Because they're tied on, they move sometimes. And then we just, you know, nudge it back into position if it gets a little out of tune. Or, you know, so the tuning system in Hindustani music is different from Western music. And we actually use different – not only do we have 12 – the 12 like semitones of Western music, quote-unquote – but we have various
tones too, right? Don't they do quarter tones?
It's not necessarily quarter tones, but we have variations of each of those. So there, in one raga, it might be this note might be slightly higher. In another raga, it's slightly lower. And then we use microtones in the bending and the curving of the notes. So Pandit Ravi Shankarji once said that Western music is cornered and Indian music is rounded.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's a really beautiful way to think about it.
It's like a fluid way to kind of play. And now, is there, is it based on like emotional playing, or are you trying to like make a reaction from a certain way that you're bending the frequency, or is it just a stylistic thing?
Both. But it's also tradition. There are like, there's a Sanskrit expression that says that which colors the mind is a raga. So a raga is supposed to create an atmosphere or a mood, a feeling, is supposed to evoke a feeling in the listener. And it's not just a scale and it's not just pathways of notes, it's also the bending of these notes. So in a particular raga, there might be a certain microtonal ornament that you have to play to evoke that certain feeling. And so you have to learn these forms in the same way that a Western musician would have to learn how to play through chord changes, right? If you're playing, you know, one of your songs and you put the lead sheet up in front of your band, they can't really just do whatever they want. I mean, we often kind of talk about that, like, oh, the freedom of creativity. But like, if you put up your song and it's in the key of E, your bass player can't, you know, just start playing in D sharp like everything's right. Cool, right? Like, right. It has to jive.
It's a language. It has to be concise, and it has to be kind of the big translatable is the best way I can kind of make that definition.
Yeah. So there are lots of these phrases, like a part of learning this music traditionally is learning these phrases and microtones and how they are used and where the scope is for creative expression and where you have to you really just have to do it this way. You know, just like with Western music, you know, if you're playing through chord changes, for example, there is a scope for creative expression there, of course, but you also have to play those chord changes right. At least a little bit.
Right.
You know, or it's just totally unrelated to what the rest of the band is doing.
So is it kind of like a mode that you always have to be able to hit within certain ragas or certain, you know, kind of tonalities?
Yeah. You know, it's a mode. Like it's much more than that, though. I guess the easiest thing for me to do would just
show it. Man. Let's hear it. This is even better, man. We get a little live performance.
I'm gonna have to tune a little bit here, please.
What I love about the sitar too is it's such a beautiful looking instrument. It's just so wild.
Isn't it great?
It's awesome. It's so awesome.
So I was just teaching my group class here, and I was teaching a raga called Charukeshi, which is not really the most ideal raga to explain what I want to, but I'll just show you. So this is the scale. So in this raga, there's not a whole lot of rules of motion. But we do play this phrase a lot. That has to be there. And then there's a certain way that we play this phrase. So you see there's that note is curved. It's not just,
it's like a bend. It's like a guitar bend.
Yes, exactly. So the way that we, I feel like in Western music, it's like a note is either bent or it's not. Whereas in Hindustani music, there's like a million different ways that you can bend it, and you have to learn to differentiate all of them and control them.
Show me two different examples, if you don't mind, of two very distinct bends, maybe on the same kind of like a relative scale.
Okay. So this is a very important thing that gets used in Indian music, the concept, and I'll be honest, I haven't necessarily heard an Indian musician talk about it this way, but I'm using my own words to describe what I'm hearing in their music.
I'm already so fascinated because like this instrument comes from where I come from and I've never even played one, you know, so this is, I'm
come
so
to my fun. House. You can play mine.
We'll make it happen, dude. We'll make it happen.
So, This is one of the most interesting things to me when I was first starting out, is the concept of two notes with a bend between them, a slide between them, and one curved note. So listen to the difference. This is with a slide between it, as opposed to this is one curved note, as opposed to two notes with a slide between it. Right? And so you can do this in both directions. Right?
Yeah.
A little flick up.
Yeah.
Or we can do it, the curves can be slow, they can be fast, they can be symmetrical, they can be asymmetrical. So here's a slow one. Right?
Yeah.
There's a fast one.
Yeah.
Here's an asymmetrical one. So I slowed down into.
Yeah, I hear it all. It sounds like you're doing it all on one, all the bends on one string, and you're having like kind of like a pedal, kind of do a droning chord. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So you can think of, so I have these three strings on the top. These are called Chikari strings, and then we have the sa string. I have my bass strings under a hook right now. We only really use them in the first movement of the performance, but like 90 to 95% of our playing is on this one string.
Wow!
And if you, I don't know if you can see, for those of you who are watching the video, the main string goes down the middle of the neck,
right? So
they're not evenly distributed across the neck like they are on a guitar.
Our bulldog wants, he's interested too. I'm listening. All right, so it comes down the middle. Yeah, I see it.
And the reason for that is so that we can pull the string. So, like, if I'm on sa, you see, I'm pulling it quite far to the end of
the... Yeah, and it looks like the frets, or what I'm going to call frets, are curved, right?
Yeah.
It looks like they're curved. So is it, you're basically kind of using it as, like, you're creating the frequency based on, like a bend, almost like a guitar bend.
Yeah, the main... You know, the essence of it is the same, although with guitar you would usually push your bends.
Push up, I was about to say.
And here we're pulling down.
Oh, that's so wicked.
The reason why the frets are curved is they function kind of like a ramp. So if you imagine trying to jump straight up, that's a lot of energy, as opposed to distributing it over a larger area like a ramp does. It's easier to move that weight to a higher elevation. So it's the same thing here. When you pull it across a curved fret, it's easier to pull the string.
And it also would, like, one thing I really find, I mean, kind of all music's like this, but really with the sitar, it's, you know, it lends itself to becoming a meditation as you're playing it. You know, it's like the frequencies are like literally meditation kind of, you know, extremities, you know, if I can use that kind of connotation. Because it's kind of, you know, it's touching on frequencies for a reason to give that reaction. Whereas sometimes you almost have to plan those out with music, but with sitar, it kind of lends itself to just being a natural part of the instrument.
Yes, that's right. And I think there is a meditative component to this music, which it should be there. It's part of the aesthetic of the music. And it can be there in other forms of music, but I would argue that it should / needs to be there in this music. So like, for example, if you're listening to like a jazz guitar player, there can be a jazz guitar player who's just like a shredder who, you know, you admire their technique and that's totally fine. But then you can have another jazz guitar player who is so deep and like really affects you
right.
in like a spiritual way. And like one of the things that I love about this music is that we're kind of required to do everything.
Wow.
So you have to be a virtuoso. You have to be deep. You have to be a composer, you know.
But it's almost like you're a spiritual guru, too, at the same time. Because, you know, anytime – that was the one thing I noticed with Ravi Shankar. You know, he was, like, really leading, kind of like a meditation ceremony. That's what it felt like. It felt like this, like, otherworldly experience that music kind of, you know, music can put you in, but that puts you in a whole different frame. You know what I mean? With the tabla, and it's like the frequencies bouncing back between the sitar and the tabla. There's just, it's just such a vibe. You know what I mean?
Indeed. Yeah. It's really, really beautiful. I would say, in terms of Panditji, I think he kind of chose to present the art form that way deliberately, for various reasons. But there are other musicians that resonate with me in that respect.
Like Nikhil Banerjee is one of them, right?
Oh, Nikhil Banerjee is like my hero.
He's deep.
His music changed my life.
Wow. He was like your major influence?
Huge. I mean, his music, I could say this without any added frou-frou-ness. His music makes me see God.
Wow.
His music.
Tell me, what's the album that you, if you were to buy, which I'm probably going to buy a Nikhil Banerjee record after this. If you were to buy one record, what would it be?
Any of them. They're just all brilliant. He's just, I think, Pandit Nikhil Banerjee, for those of you who don't know, Pandit means maestro. It's a title that we use to honor certain respected musicians. Pandit for Hindus and Ustad for Muslims. I guess I'm not allowed to have any title because I'm Jewish, so.
You got to make your own, man. Maybe a combination. You just got to put like a different, you know, Jewish suffix at the end of it.
I do get a little kick out of some of my Hindu followers give me Pandit and some of my Muslim followers give me Ustad. So
you can do like Pundish, you know?
One of my friends there in LA calls me Cohen Saab.
I like it. See, I approve of those, man. I'll record out. Let's play something that you've done and give us a little backstory. What do you want us to play first?
Sure. So this is, I think you have my new album there, which is Time Does Not Exist for Light.
I love the title, by the way.
Thank you.
So killer. So killer.
So do you know what it's referencing?
No.
This blew my mind, actually. I was watching a Neil deGrasse Tyson thing from like the 90s. He's doing like a stand-up like lecture type thing. And he was saying that that photon, as you approach the speed of light, time slows down, right?
Right.
And when you travel at the speed of light, time stops. And photons don't accelerate up to the speed of light. They are emitted or born at the speed of light, and they travel at that speed until they are absorbed by something. So a photon can be emitted from an atom and travel billions of years and then be absorbed by the leaf of a plant or something. And from the perspective of the photon, that's the same instant.
Wow. No,
like it could have been traveling billions of years, but for the photon, time doesn't exist.
That's crazy, dude. That chills, man.
It's unbelievable.
You know, it's those kind of things that we kind of take for granted in day-to-day interactions or like, you know, the world is a marvelous experience, and it's because of things like that that we kind of aren't really hip to in or think about on the daily, you know, but it's like life is a magnificent experience because of concepts like that, you know?
Amen, brother.
Well, let's play. Which track are we going to play first?
Let's go with maybe track number 2. You want to do a little bit from track number 2?
Yeah, let's do it. Ronan, let's play track number 2. Don't forget to turn off original sound. Thank you. Stuff, dude.
Thank you.
Very, very cool. Very cool. Just takes you and gets you into that place. I have to ask, and I was listening to some of the record that you sent. How do you know when a song is done? Because you have long journeys. Like it just like it just seems like that that would be crazy to know when it's ended or when it's the right take. How do you get to that place?
How do you know when a conversation with your friend is over?
I mean, you just feel it. But when you can, you know, but when you can, it's this is something I fight. And I think on every record, I was just discussing this a couple weeks ago. It's like when I first started making records, I wanted them to be perfect. And now as I make records, I want them to be perfectly flawed. I want more human errors, more human mistakes, more things to make you feel something.
Yeah.
Push the boundaries. And so I fight that, you know, like with something like what you're doing, it'd be real easy to want to edit or want to, you know, like take certain takes, but you know, it defies the experience if you do that. You know, it's like, do you kind of take one stab and you're like, that's it? Or do you take like a couple different takes and then decide on one of the takes?
Yeah, you know, it's I definitely do a little bit of editing, mostly with takes, maybe like big cuts, but not. It's not definitely not like a pop album where you're going to go in and right. manipulate every little thing and
right.
You know, music lives and breathes, and just like, you know, someone that you're in love with, they're not perfect, and you learn to love the imperfections. That's part of what makes them a beautiful, unique human. And music is the same. You know, in this era of digital music and digital everything, I think we could all use a little bit more imperfection imperfection with love.
Yes.
And you know, not try to hide our humanity, you know?
I couldn't agree. You said it perfectly. It's like, and I feel like music will come back to that. It goes through this new vortex of, oh, everything can be perfect and auto-tuned and corrected and edited. That's why I do records on tape, you know, because
I love tape.
You can't do that. You cannot edit like you can on digital. It's like it either is going to be, it's going to feel right. And the great thing I love about tape too is you're listening. You're not looking. You are not looking at all. You are literally just listening to see if it's the right take. And it teaches you just to kind of get into that zone, and you relinquish the power to edit completely.
You know, there's a magic to tape. You know, I had this experience. So this album actually, so it was recorded in the UK in a freezing cold warehouse, actually. Like my hands were like ice cold for this entire recording session. In March in like just outside Manchester, England, in this warehouse that had no heat.
That's gonna affect your tuning for sure.
And it was released in the record label Worlds Within Worlds is based in Sydney, Australia. I was on tour there last August, and I had this experience. I performed in Canberra, and the fellow who organized this concert, he's an audiophile, and he had this big reel-to-reel quarter-inch tape machine from like the 70s, and he like carried it down to the gig where I was playing, and he plugged it into the board, and he recorded me directly from the board.
Oh, wow.
And I got off the stage, as I always do, grumpy because I'm just hearing all the things that I think I could do better. And the next morning, I woke up and I hear some music in the next room, and I go in there and I'm like, what is this? And in my mind, I'm like, this sounds really good. What is this? And he's like, this is last night.
And you're like, what? What?
Yeah, I was blown away. I'm like, this sounds so much better than I thought. And like, part of it is like, whether you think you played great or you think you played terribly, you're always wrong. You know?
Right. That's very true.
But I think another part of it is just like, analog tape makes everything sound so much better.
Everything. Anything sustained, anything that has kind of a tonal sustenance or any kind of a, you know, sustained tone, like a voice, a violin, a sitar, anything, it just sounds better. Everything sounds better. And I also find that drums sound better. Everything sounds better. So I'm a huge fan of tape. And it was, you know, you don't know this, but, or maybe you do. So you played on the new NK Band record, which we're about to release. You're on the opening track, man.
Wow.
You are the intro. You're one of the first things people hear. And it's funny because it's like, you know, there's so many things about that intro song. It's just like this rootsy introduction to the whole record, where it's like it has all these didgeridoos and sitars and, you know, a human voice and a vocoder and all this weird like collision of tonalities and everything. And it's only 30 seconds long, but it just having the sitar puts you right into that meditative, chant like ceremonial part of a listening experience, and everything you played on it was so great. So,
thanks so much.
Thank you for opening the record, by the way. Most people don't know this, now they do, but the cool thing is, it's like, you know, that instrument just lends itself to being like a very therapeutic and soothing sound, and I'm sure that puts an extra amount of pressure on you when you're performing. Tell me what you're kind of channeling or what you're thinking about when you're playing, because there's got to be a part of it that's a meditation, but then there's that artist side of you that wants it to be perfectly flawed or a perfect performance or a perfect expression. Tell me what, like, you know, mental things or games you're playing with yourself.
You know, as I mature and I get older and gain experience, you know, I often think about something. I asked my teacher, so I learned with many people, but the main teacher that I reference is Ustad Ali Akbar Khan Saab, who is a towering figure of the music. For those of you who have ever heard his music, you'll know who I'm talking about. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, then go listen to some of his music right away. Ali Akbar Khan.
Oh, he's a
just bad. Like one of the greatest musical geniuses of forever, really. And I asked him one time after class that same question. What do you think about when you play? And he looked at me and he said, nothing.
Yeah.
And
I knew he was going to say that. I was going to say he doesn't think, you know?
Yeah. And I said, really, nothing. And he said, he cut off his hand. And this gives me, when I'm really playing well, I'm sitting in the front row and my father is playing.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that heavy?
That's heavy. I love that.
Yeah. And I think that that really embodies the same thing that Kenny Werner talks about in his book, Effortless Mastery, where he's talking about channeling. You know, we as musicians, we have to do so much work to imbibe this this language. The same way we're talking right now. We're not thinking about the grammar of English while we're speaking. We're just expressing ideas and reacting to each other in the moment. And the language is coming out in a unconscious way because we have mastered it. And so these days, what I'm thinking about when I perform is I am trying to be as present and relaxed as possible. I'm really not trying to think about music at all. I'm just trying to
be the instrument.
Yeah, to just be present and be relaxed. And if I can achieve that state, then it's going to be a good concert.
Don't you find, I find that throughout a performance, I'm always like fighting to get to that place. And when you're in that place, it's almost like you can't be conscious of it. It has to flow through you and you have to just let it flow through you until you become conscious that it's all happening and then it slips through your fingers.
You know? Well, you just said the key word, right? You're fighting to get to that place. And, you know, there's this Buddhist concept of duality, right? To try without trying and to be without being, right? And that's the thing. Like, this is what I've realized as well in my own music. And it is a struggle every time because, like, the music's important to you and you want to do well. Yes. But the harder you try, the worse it gets.
Yes.
So you have to try without trying, right? Like, you as your very nature are going to try because the music is important to you. So you don't need to try because that's your standard way of being.
Right. I always think there are these two Buddhist monks I saw, I think it was like on a National Geographic thing. And it's something I think about all the time because they take these colored sands, right? And they'll put it on a table, like a big wooden table. And they will spend months taking these colored sands and just putting a light string or a light kind of piece of wood and making these really cool little circles, and all of different colors. And when it's all finished after months, they sit there and they completely destroy the work. Yeah. And like, I remember seeing that and just going, what, why would you do that? You just spent months doing that. And it's just like the whole concept is to not be emotionally attached to the end results is what the whole point of creation is.
Exactly.
It's like, oh my God, when they said that, I was just like, man, that is the end all be all point of being a creator. So
yeah.
It's kind of,
I would, I mean, that's incredibly powerful. And I would just add to that, that, you know, our own perceptions of our own music is kind of irrelevant.
Yes.
Because like one example that I like to tell my students a lot is Ravel. Ravel wrote a piece called Bolero, which
one of his most famous pieces.
It's his most famous piece, and he hated it.
Right.
You know? So, like, the fact that Ravel hated it doesn't really matter because everybody else loved it. And, like, if you have, if your favorite track on your new album is the least popular track, it's sort of irrelevant that it's, I mean, it's relevant to you, but it's not relevant to anybody else.
Yes.
So, you know, we as artists and as creators often get attached to our own perceptions of our art, but really, like, we make it and send it out into the world, and how they interact with it is not up to us.
Let me ask you, you got these amazing opportunities to travel to India to perform and learn. So tell me what both those experiences were like, both as a student and as a performer, when you got the opportunities in each capacity.
Yeah, so I first went to India in 2006, I think, as a Fulbright scholar. And I was in Jaipur and then Calcutta. That was an unbelievable experience. I was there for about a year, and I learned so much. It really gave me a much deeper contextual understanding of the music, because this music is so firmly rooted in the culture of South Asia. You know, we really have to, as me as a non-native practitioner of the music, I work really hard to honor that tradition and represent it ethically and positively. I definitely learned a lot, both musically and culturally. And then I've been back to India pretty much every year since then, with the exception of a couple of years that I've missed here or there. And for the last 5 years or so, my trips have kind of shifted from being primarily about learning and listening to being more about performing. I've gotten some pretty amazing opportunities to perform at some really big music festivals in India. And I'm happy and incredibly honored to say that I'm embraced in India as a performer.
And that's a big deal, because, you know, you are technically an outsider for the style of music.
So yeah, I call myself an immigrant. I'm a musical immigrant.
Which is so cool, because it's usually the opposite, you know, where somebody like comes to another country and is, you know, a newbie to that style. So that's our culture representing the warm welcome to bring you in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you and me are actually kind of reciprocals of each other.
Yes. And I, like, the funny thing is, like, I'm from India, and, like, the funny thing is, when I was going in music, I didn't want to do anything Indian, because I was like, oh, I've been around that my whole life. I want to do, you know, pop music and rock music. And now I find myself, I've been exploring so much world music with African music and all kinds of other stuff, that now I know that India's like, that's that last destination that I want to venture through, because it's like coming, circling back around. So
yeah,
well, that's why doing this interview is also super fascinating for me, because it's touching upon a lot of you know, things that I just love about music and the culture, you know.
That's beautiful. You know, I think Hindustani music, I mean, there's also another form of classic. I mean, India is a huge place, and South Asia is a gigantic place. There's a million different musical traditions. The one that I'm trained in is Hindustani music, which is one of the classical traditions. There's also Carnatic music, which is a different classical tradition from South India.
Yeah, that's where I'm from, by the way.
Yeah, I could tell by your last name.
I'm from Kerala, actually. And yeah? My last name is Karula. So a lot of people are like, you're from Kerala and your last name is Karula? I'm like, yeah, it's just a chance. It's weird.
But I really think that Hindustani music is one of the world's great musical traditions. I think it's one of the oldest, and it's one of the greatest treasures we have as humanity. And listen to it and enjoy it and you know, appreciate this amazing thing that the subcontinent has given the world.
Let's play, speaking of exposure, let's play track 4 from your record, and just give us a little backstory before we play it.
Great. So this is an evening melody called Ragashri. We kind of just did this in one take, actually. We needed a little extra music on the album, and I didn't know what to play. So I was like, oh, let's just play this. And it turned out pretty well. So we decided to put it on the album. It's usually described as a romantic melody. It's quite lyrical and tuneful, and it's kind of a perennial favorite. In India, it's one of the most popular melodies.
All right, let's hear it. Thank you. beautiful, man. Seriously. Just crazy, crazy soul. That was actually my favorite track on the of the five that you sent. I don't know what it was, but it just I just responded to it, and I was just deeply in it when I was listening to it. So I definitely
this speaks to what I was just saying before, because after I recorded it, I hated that take.
Wow,
awesome,
so beautiful, thank you so much. So great. And you also played tablas, right? You played
tablas? Not really, just for fun, you know.
So is that kind of like you kind of look at that as like that's your backbeat, or is it just supporting kind of what you're doing?
So the tabla is an accompaniment instrument. So it's providing the rhythmic cycle. So the first track you heard, that one is in a rhythmic cycle of 11 beats called Chartal Kisuwari. This one that we just heard was in 16 beats called Tintal, which is, it was slow Tintal. So it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, like that speed. So the tabla player is, there's a certain kind of groove that they're playing. You can think of it like a vamp. In India, or in Indian music, or Hindustani music, we'd call it teka. But the tabla player is never going to play what's written in the book for the teka. They're going to decorate it and interact with you. The same way, like, if you show, like, your drummer what the beat is, like, they're not going to play that thing exclusively, right? It's, that's just the basis. And then, so what I'm playing, like, when the tabla first comes in there, I'm playing what's called the gut. And the gut is a fixed melody, which marks the rhythmic cycle, and that serves as a refrain for all my improvisations. And so when I go back and I play the gut, then the tabla player will take a solo. They'll start improvising and come back to beat one or come back to the beginning of the gut, and then we switch off that way.
Real quick, I want to end with the last track. Where can people find you if they want to find your music? Give us all your social handles and all that.
Yeah, so you can Google my name, Josh Feinberg, sitar. I'm the only Josh Feinberg that plays sitar. So
spell it out because people are dumb, man.
So Josh. Actually, you could just do Josh Sitar. My website is joshsitar.com.
That's pretty easy. And that's S-I-T-A-R, right?
Yes, S-I-T-A-R. My music is available on iTunes. It's available on Amazon, all the digital platforms. You could also purchase it directly from my website. If you'd like my last name, it's F like Frank, E-I-N-B-E-R-G, Feinberg.
Awesome. All right, we're going to play this one last track, and then we'll come back and just say a quick sign off. And Josh, thank you so much for being such a great guest, man. It's been awesome.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real honor.
No problem. All right, let's play this last track. Thank you. Yeah, man. Josh, you've been a wonderful guest. Josh Feinberg, joshsitar.com. Is that right?
That's right.
Dude, thank you so much. We've got to collaborate a lot more. And, dude, thank you for being such a wonderful guest. We'll have to have you back on next record or next 6 to 9 months when you got more things going on that you're doing already again and again and again, man. We're going to just keep having you back.
Thank you so much. It would be my pleasure.
Awesome, Josh. Thank you so much. Take care, and we wish you so much luck on this musical journey that you're on, man. Stay healthy, stay safe, okay?
Thank you so much. You too, and same to all of your listeners out there.
Yeah, man. And I'll send you the record when it's done.
Yes, please do. I can't wait to hear it.
All right, man. Be good, dude. Thanks, man.
Take care. Thank you.